soldiers.
I hate soldiers.
Asatsu.
Asatsu.
Foul.
Api.
Api. In spite of. Teisham.
Teisham.
Of all of them. Ramatta.
Too
attached.
Nihanam.
Destruction. Pashyan.
Having been experienced.
Api. Although. Na.
Does not.
Pashyati. See it. Translation. Persons devoid of Atmatattva do not inquire into the problems of life. Being too attached with fallible soldiers like the body, children, and wife. Although sufficiently experienced, they still do not see their inevitable destruction. Purport. This material world is called the world of death. Every living being, beginning from Brahma, whose duration of life is some thousands of millions of years, down to the germs who live for a few seconds only, are struggling for existence. Therefore, this life is a sort of fight for material nature, which imposes death upon all. In the human form of life, a living being is competent enough to come to an understanding of this great struggle for existence. But being too attached to family members, society, country, etc., he wants to win over the invincible material nature by the aid of bodily strength, children, wife, relatives, etc. Although he is sufficiently experienced in the matter by dint of past experience and previous examples of his deceased predecessors, he does not see that the so-called fighting soldiers like the children, relatives, society members, and countrymen are all fallible in the great struggle. One should examine the fact that his father or his father's father has already died, and that he himself is therefore also sure to die. And similarly, his children, who are the would-be fathers of their children, will also die in due course. No one will survive in the struggle of material nature. The history of human society definitely proves it. Yet the foolish people still suggest that in the future they will be able to live perpetually with the help of material science. This poor fund of knowledge exhibited by human society is certainly misleading, and it is all due to ignoring the constitution of the living soul. This material world exists only as a dream due to our attachment to it. Otherwise, the living soul is always different from the material energy. The great ocean of material nature is tossing with the waves of time, and the so-called living conditions are something like foaming bubbles, which appear before us as bodily self, wife, children, society, countrymen, etc. Due to a lack of knowledge of self, we become victimized by the force of ignorance, and thus spoil the valuable energy of human life in a vain search after permanent living conditions, which are impossible in this material world. Our friends, relatives, and so-called wives and children are not only fallible, but also bewildered by the outward glamour of material existence. As such, they cannot save us. Still, we think we are safe within the orbit of family, society, or country. The whole materialistic advancement of human civilization is like the decoration of a dead body. Everyone is a dead body flapping only for a few days, and yet all the energy of human life is being wasted in the decoration of this dead body. Sukadeva Goswami is pointing out the duty of the human being after showing the actual position of bewildered human activities. Persons who are devoid of knowledge of Atmatattva are misguided, but those who are devotees of the Lord and have perfect realization of transcendental knowledge are not bewildered. So we see in the mode of goodness, then something is bitter in the beginning and sweet at the end. So the Bhagavatam, being the Saptic Purana, the pure Sattvic Purana, then we see it starts off because this is the beginning of the narration of Sukadev Goswami. So he's bringing about the reality of existence. So it's not very sweet, a little bitter. But that reality exists. We see Prabhupada in the purport is very, also taking the same mood of being very, very realistic. Right? This is important. Means we have all our devotional activities, we have our ways that we connect everything to Krishna. And that's the positive application of what we have. But it's also important that we know or remember that the material energy itself is what it is, and our position in it is what it is. So therefore, then this opening like this, which is very frank and very clear, that the material energy has nothing to offer. And what we are endeavoring for on the material platform is not actually going to help us. Right? Parents are taking care of the husband gets the wife, you know, supposedly to give shelter to his emotions, give that support. And then children come, you know, for the wife, then the husband will give support, give facility. Then they have children, then that is so much a nice interaction of emotions and experience there. But then there's underlying the idea that when we are old, then the children will take care. Maybe they take care, maybe they don't. Even if they do take care, then the point is made, we still die. We're not going to save us from death. Then the interesting thing to note is this fruitive mentality that, and this controlling mentality that I am working hard, therefore my facilities take care of me. I have raised my children, therefore they will take care of me. I've done my work, I will get my reward. But then, immediately after death, there's birth. Right? And somebody's taking care of you. You've done nothing for those souls. Right? Who are your parents? You haven't done anything for. Right? You cry, you know, you make a mess out of your diapers, you know, you make yourself complete, absolute, you know, center of attention. Right? You know, dealing with not great qualities, so then we can understand that there's something else at work, there's God at work here. Otherwise, why should these people take care of it for 20 years, 40 years? Then maybe when they're old again. Because maybe it will, maybe it won't. Right? So that must be God's hand is in there. Right? We're just looking at it from this life. But there's another way. You can look at it, take the middle of this life to the middle of the next life. You know, you could move it anywhere. It's not just the birth and then there's the death and then that's it. No, because right after that there's the birth again. So in other words, all these things that we're working for are illusory. And that situation has to be very, very clear. It's not palatable. We've heard it a million times. We know all that. You know, people use this, we feel, to their own advantage or harass us or make us feel uncomfortable. But whatever the situation, it still has to be understood. Someone's on the battlefield, they can't think that they're, you know, sitting in the Garden of Eden, right? They have to know they're on the battlefield. Then out of that, then there's the relationships there, the camaraderie, the facilities they have, that will get them through. But still, it's a battlefield. If they don't think it's a battlefield, they'll have a problem. They'll get injured or they'll get killed. So in the same way as we really think material energy is going to do something for us, then we will suffer. Guaranteed. We will be let down. It's just the way it is. It's meant like that. Even if everything goes nice, you will die. Right? And you let somebody down. Right? It's an interesting phenomenon. Right? The father dies, And then the children blame him, why did he go away? It's as if he, you know, made a choice like that. He made a choice, yes, I'm going to step out into the street and get run over by a Mack truck just so, like, children will, you know, have to fend for themselves and become tough. And if, no, it just happens. But still, one is blamed. Oh, you let us down, you left us, you weren't there when we needed you. Right? So we're going to let somebody down at some point, no matter how well we do. And therefore, because we're letting them down, they let us down. It's just material energy. So if we understand this, then we start to look at it more carefully. Because the material temporary relationships are just that, and they're going to remain that. But the eternal relationships based on service to Krishna, that is something more viable. Because the relationship with Krishna is eternal. Therefore, relationship with the devotees as devotees is eternal. The material relationships will fall away, but the spiritual will remain. So in that level, we won't be let down. Does this make some sense? You know? So even though it may not be a nice topic, still it has to be approached, because only then does knowledge work. Because if otherwise we'll be so absorbed in the emotional interaction that we forget to use the intelligence. So the first thing is use the intelligence, figure out where we are, and this is not a great place. Then we use the intelligence, okay, how to connect this to Krishna, right? Because it's only so stark if it's not connected to Krishna, right? Think about it. Everything is there, all your facilities, your normal lifestyle, all your activities are all there. And if the people that are important to you are there, it's great. But you take out of that same scene the important person or persons, the whole thing's empty. Right? It's empty as far as the whole planet, you know, or the whole universe. It's empty. Does that make sense? So that's the point. You take out Krishna and all the material activities of whatever situation we are, it's empty. And it's as stark and as rough, exactly as it's said here. There's not one word that's not exactly right. Right? And anybody who thinks this is an exaggeration or we've heard that or it's too much is an illusion. Right? But if you add Krishna, then it becomes okay. Right? Then it's nice. So this is the difference between the Griha Medhi and the Grihastha. Grihastha then, Krishna is the center. So then it becomes okay, because everything's connected to him. There is a positive aspect. By dealing and engaging all one's needs and attachments in Krishna's service, one is elevated. One develops. One spiritually advances, and at the same time is able to give up one's connection to the material energy, the finding of its importance. But if it's not, then it's just as stark as what's here, because this is the situation. So it's only because Krishna is added that this starkness becomes softened by the performance of devotional service. But that's the point. The material world is this stark. It is exactly what it says here. We may have excuses, reasons, but it's just as it is here. Right? If we think about it honestly, we'll see it's exactly right. And because we know it, that's why we're all sitting here. Right? If we didn't know it, we wouldn't be sitting here. We'd be sitting somewhere else, you know, being busy doing all these things, you know, making money, maintaining family, all these things. So we're here in Krishna consciousness, we're here in mind, because we know that the material existence doesn't work right. So that's the point, is that if we add into it Krishna, then we can look at the positive sides of it. But we can never be, how do you say, relaxed just like you may have a tame lion or tiger, right? So it's workable. But you always have to remember that it's a wild animal, right? Otherwise, you'd be in trouble, right? There's people in Australia, then they catch crocodiles, right? These big 30-foot crocodiles and all that. And they take care of them and feed them and all that, and are nice to them and all that. And they have a particular kind of rasa. You know, basically it's the, how you say, the one who provides food, and the food who is providing food that hasn't been caught yet, basically. So, like that, then they have a very close relationship, you know, and so you just don't want the relationship to get too intimate, because the crocodile has its own concept of intimacy. Means you're sitting on the bottom of the river under a rock. That's what it means, is close, you know, like that. So that's the whole thing. One always has to remember is that the material energy is what it is, and we're making the best use of a bad bargain by engaging these things. So when we do engage, we do our best, we give our fullness. That's another point, is that Prabhupada makes us, whatever we do it properly. So whatever activity in life we do it fully. But we always remember the condition of the material world, and we always remember Krishna, his position, and our relationship to him, and the process of attaining him, right? By being absorbed in his name, form, qualities, and pastimes. This makes some sense, right? So it's clear. It's important that it opens like this, because it sets the platform. Then from this, he'll start showing how the Lord is in the material energy through the universal form. But what he's really bringing out is that the chanting of the holy name, this is the important element, right? By being absorbed in Krishna's devotional service, then things work. Any questions on this, or comments? Or?
You say that only for few moments, then that everybody's trying to struggle, even if everybody's going to die. So many times we see it in a very dangerous situation, it's unavoidable death. Everybody struggles in the middle of an ocean and a fire. People struggle until the last second. There's no time for it. He's giving up his travel as well. How we can prepare really for this last minute without struggling?
How can we prepare for the last minute without struggling? Because the nature is the struggle for the last moment. It means one always is going to take shelter of what's the most dear to you. Right? That's the important element. So if the Lord is the most dear, then in the difficult situations, one immediately takes shelter of Krishna. Like we see the Vrajavasis, when these big demons would walk into Vrindavan, then immediately they would cry out for Krishna, or the forest fire, anything, any calamity, immediately they take shelter of Krishna. So that's the thing, when Krishna is the most dear thing to you in your life, then whenever there's a difficulty, you know, and death is definitely a difficulty, then we'll remember Krishna. That's the point. So that's why the process of taking, understanding by knowledge the actuality of the material world, and it's not actually the place we're attached to. I mean, that's important for us. But as said here, although sufficiently experienced, they still not see that their inevitable destruction. So even though we're experienced in the material world as a place of misery, still if there's anybody, you know, deals nicely with us, smiles at us, then immediately we're ready to reciprocate. So then those elements that still, out of habit, maintain their importance in our lives, then we interact with them connected to Krishna. So those elements that we can directly connect to Krishna, we do. That's the best. But those elements that are not directly connected to Krishna, then we indirectly connect them to Krishna so that they become purified and our need for them and our the importance of them for us becomes purified. Does that make sense? So that in both situations, always remembering, never forgetting, Krishna is the common element. So he becomes prominent. So by that practice and that endeavor, then at the moment of death, then we take shelter of Krishna. Is that okay?
Is it the first canto of the chapter, the Pandavas entire timing. At the right timing, until they were still strong, the kingdom was flourishing, and they left were preparing for dying. How is it applies to Krishna consciousness to the devotees? What moment we should really do now? Get serious about this.
Get serious for preparation for death. Well, there's two points. One is that death can happen at any moment, so therefore one endeavors in one's spiritual achievement as if one's going to die in the next moment. Right? So that's always a constant element. But that doesn't mean one gets depressed or tamasic, because that means there's attachment. Depression means attachment. Because when a desire is frustrated, it creates an anger. You know, and then when that anger is hopeless, then there's then it becomes depression. You know? So it still is coming from attachment. You know, that's the point. You know? And if that increases more, then it goes to insanity. So it's all based on ignorance. Right? So that element's there. The other is that one is performing one's duties, the children are grown, one sees the white hairs, you know, and especially if one sees the children's children. So that's the typical formula. When the hair is gray and you see your children's children, then it's time to, you know, start to pull out. That's the general principle. But once it sees then what is favorable, because there's always more you can do. The material energy can always be worked on. You know, I'm sure if Caesar was here, he'd still, you know, Italy would still be flourishing. You know, they'd still have the, you know, the Europe under control and everything would be going nice, you know. But unfortunately, he had to stop his work rather suddenly, you know, at the, the desire of his associates, you know, they kind of like, worked to inspire him to give up, you know, all his material endeavor for expanding the kingdom. So, work is always going to be there. It's never going to be perfect. There's never going to be that perfect time where everything is done and every last cent that could possibly ever be used is in the bank and every house is bought and mortgages paid and everything, because they all still, you still need to maintain the house, you still got to put petrol in the car, you still got to feed everybody. You know, you can't do it. But where one has, according to what position, worked one's best, it's that. That's one element. But the other is it's the time when you could become, pull out, become more Krishna conscious in one's full time endeavors. And, you know, that works with the family. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, depending on what it is, then one goes with the wife or the wife stays with the family, whatever is the most favorable. But that element, at one point, it has to be seen, because they only say, oh, well, left. But when you die, you leave also. So it's just a matter of when you leave. You know what I'm saying? It's like you have to go to Calcutta to catch the train at 12. Right? Okay, so you should be there ideally an hour before, so you can get in there, comfortably find the train, figure out where the bogey is, everything. Then to do that, then you need, you know, 3 hours to get there, plus you have to get across Calcutta, that's another hour. So you need 4 hours like that. And then if you want to say, well, in case of emergency, throw in a little bit more. So you'd want to leave at 6 in the morning. But, so you could leave then, and then people will say, oh, but you're going so early. So you could say, okay, I'll go at 7, I'll cut out that hour, you know, and then, you know, okay, I'll cut off some off of the, you know, time in the station, half an hour, so 7 to... So it's just, you have to go at some point. So it's just a matter of, it's understood by everybody that this is the way it is, then it works nice. But if the attachment is too much there in others, then that's there. The difficulty is we tend to leave the attachment, because if there's knowledge, we're also worried that then we'll lose out on our emotional exchange. Subconsciously, we don't necessarily want the family members to become too Krishna conscious, because then it's their need for us that makes us feel important. Right? That's why we're in the family life, because we're needed. You know, as soon as we're not needed, that's when, you know, the trauma starts. So there's the tendency to not train. You know, it's just like the 5-year-old kid can put on his tilak, brush his teeth, put on his dhoti, and do everything. I've seen it. But the tendency is they're still 10 years old, they're still being fed and dressed and everything. Because the need is, then the emotional exchange is there. So socially it's very nice, emotionally it's very nice. So we also have to watch that, is that the family should be trained in what is actually the material existence and how the temporariness is of it. But to do that nicely without it being dry and non-interactive, so that we still maintain the emotional exchange, is performance of duties. Right? As we see in the example of the family in Ekachakra. You know, that it was there, the Pandavas were staying at their house. They knew, you know, it was quite obvious, somebody in the family's got to go, right? Baka is hungry, and, you know, one of them is dinner. So then their relationship is maintaining, but it's based on religious principles, based on duty. Husband, I'm the head of the family, I'm supposed to protect and see all you, so you all stay here protected, I'll go. Wife is, no, without the husband we won't be protected, and this and that, and you're the one protecting, so if I go, you can always marry someone else, you know, because, you know, every, you know, properly trained woman is going to take care of the kids and, you know, be like, make it, be part of the family. And the daughter says, well, the daughter leaves the family anyway, so I might as well leave now, you know, says, we're not, you know, we're only temporarily part of the family. Like that. So, but it's all based on their maintaining that intense interaction between each other, but it's based on religious principles. And this is in the face of death. So that's one of the main keys, is to have this knowledge of the material world, but so that's understood fully, and to perform one's prescribed duties fully. Then one has the proper experience that one's looking for, but one has the knowledge by which it will slowly, slowly fade away. You know? That's there. And then the third element would be then Krishna. That attachment to Krishna. Because it fades away, but it's got to go somewhere. So unless it goes to Krishna, then it will come back again. That's what happens to the persons. They go to the Brahman, but they'll come back because there's nothing to do there. So that's got to be, the family members have to know this, and it's not lamentable, it's just understood as fact, just like you have to breathe, or you have to go to the toilet, or you have to eat or sleep, it's just fact. So if that's accepted, then life goes okay, you know. So then this is also accepted. Everybody's going to go at some point. It's not something we overemphasize, but it's known, and everybody knows what to do, so... Therefore, the emphasis on performing one's prescribed duties in connection to Krishna becomes the prominent element, you know, of family interaction. More important than that is the devotional service. Does that make sense? So that will also then accomplish your first question of making Krishna the most prominent, so ultimately one takes shelter there. Is that okay?
You train every good for to meet the gopi and everything, but coming to an age, they don't want music with the Krishna, they don't want coming to the temple, they don't want. It's not my case, no? But I look some young person here, the father, they are very good devotees, they train in other things, but after it, becoming one age, like 16, 17, 18, they don't want music. This I am very afraid with this.
Translation? Well, because I kind of get, I'm not sure. Question, we're investigating at this point when we find the lady.
She's very afraid when you reach that age, she's even though good training, good parents, then the kid wants.
The question is about a kid.
Yeah.
Okay. So the kids, even though they've gone through good training, good association, good parentage, when they get to a certain age, they tend to not be interested in Krishna consciousness. Okay. The point is that one is going to do what one values. You know what I'm saying? And that value is going to be based, and the value is a lot going to come from the parent. So this is where we go back into this opening with the starkness, right? Because even though we have an idea, and we feel the children are different, many times when we check, the children are exactly the same as us, unless they make the conscious effort to make an adjustment in it. I'll give an example. Parent is saying, my kid never goes to the temple. Right? What they mean, the translation is that, is I never go to the temple, but I've decided I'll go once a week. Right? But my kid won't go once a week when I go, therefore, by my definition, he never goes to the temple. Right? They go on big festivals when all the other, second generation is there and there's a big feast and all that. They are there. But what it means is, as I go, in the detail that I go, my children don't go. So that's what's seen as a difference in the generations, the generation gap. But actually, if you look at it, in principle, they're exactly the same. The parent is not going every day to the temple. They go when they please. They've just decided that, okay, every Sunday we'll go. And so the child follows the same principle, I will only go when I please, but they only please to go at big festivals. You understand? So like that is every parent can look at what their child is doing. If it's not exactly the same as them in principle, the detail is different. Right? Because, so that's an important element. Like that. It's an important element. Because the child will naturally pick up the values of the parent. They're made of the combination of the consciousness of their parents. And their first formative years, they gain that from the parents. They're unknown. They're not conscious of it. But their whole value system, their social values, economic, their everything is there is done in those formative years. That's the system. Vedic system is, that's why before school, actually the whole foundation of their personage is established then. Most don't know that. They think they'll train it later, but that's actually when they get it. They just get it by association. Then they go to school, and then the teachers make them aware of what they have gained from the parents, or what they should be gaining from the parents. Then once they're aware, then they can go back to the parents and the actual, useful members of the family and community. But in between those two places, they're not of great value to the family. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Or not? Means the family is working on attachment means because this person is mine. Naturally, they think like I think. They'll do everything that I value. But they're actually separate souls. They don't. by fundamentals, they will be because they've grown up together with you. But in actual conscious decisions, it may be completely different. Right? Does that make sense? The mother loves parties, so she's always having people over. The kids also are very social, but they decide to have their parties somewhere else. And they're not always never at home. I'm always at home. Why are they so different? No, they're exactly the same. Like that. The difficulty with this is like these first verses of Bhagavatam. They're a little harsh because it means atmatattva. We have to actually look at who we are and what's going on. But the reality is it's not different. You know, it's said. Dharma Shastra says, if you put an eggplant seed into a field, it will produce an eggplant. It won't produce something else. Right? The better the field, the better the quality of eggplant. Right? So if the nature of the seed and the nature of the field match, right? You know, like spinach likes to grow in sand. Right? But some other things, they like to grow in clay. So when the field matches the seed, you get a really good child. Does that make sense? But the point is the child is going to be the same, yes.
If the child is exactly the same as the parents, how come that for most of us Western devotees at least, we are here as devotees, and for many of us, our parents were not so pious.
Okay, so how is it that we are here as devotees when our parents weren't devotees? Because devotional service is separate from this whole process. But if you will notice, how you live in your house, how you eat, how you sit, how you dress is the same as if you weren't a devotee. How your social life in your house is very similar to your parents. You understand? You come from a middle class background, we walk into your house, we'll see a middle class house. You know what I'm saying? We're going to see that same kind of way of pictures on the walls, but now the Krishna pictures, but still the same kind of thing, the same little, you know, this furniture, that furniture, you know, it's all still the same, you know, designed in the, you know, 60s, 70s kind of, you know, viewpoint, you know, a little upbeat, hippie, you know, yuppie kind of, you know, at best. You know what I'm saying? So that's the same. The material is going to be the same. That's why social interactions aren't necessarily great, because we tend to interact a bit like those who are not cultured. You know what I'm saying? But spiritually, because it has nothing to do with the one, therefore you see devotees, despite the background, are very fixed in the philosophy of Krishna consciousness and the execution of that. No devotee, no matter how much on the outer edges of Krishna consciousness is there, they will all be determined to develop love for Krishna, and they know the processes by chanting. They're all fixed in that. But the determination to, you know, follow it and everything else due to their material desire and other things like that, that may be very different. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So that element is there. But it doesn't mean that by knowledge one can't change that. That's the whole process. By knowledge, you can pull something out of the mind, re-deal with it, and put it back in. You know what I'm saying? Like that. The child grew up in a family, it was wild, it was crazy, and they're conscious. Right? If they just emotionally go through it, then when they grow up, they'll do the same with their kids. But if they look at it and go, this is crazy, this is not right, and they analyze why it's not right, then they'll be careful to not do that with their children. But it's coming from the principle of intelligence. And it's still in the same field, they're just reversing it. You know? Because many times you see they go the opposite. The parents were very strict, they're too liberal. Parents are too strict, they're too liberal, they can't hit the middle. But it's still based off that they intellectually changed it. So that's the whole key is that devotionally, then that we perform the activities and with the heart and with the knowledge. And socially, then we understand the proper, what is proper. And then through the performance of prescribed duties, then socially we'll interact properly. You know, because it's our social duty, it's our prescribed duty that we should behave in a nice way, in a cultured way. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Mark, is that the relationship on the pure platform are temporary? And if it's connected with Krishna, then it's eternal. To me, it sounds also a bit too general, because devotees often don't see each other on the platform of Shuddha Sattva. We are just seeing the mind, the intelligence, the body. Mm-hmm. You know, this seems to me not eternal to me.
Not
eternal, because unless there's really...
Means our vision is eternal. I mean, not eternal. What we were meaning there is that you have a family and they're all committed to serving in Prabhupada's mission, assisting Rupa Goswami in Radha Krishna's pastimes, you know, and assisting in Rupa Goswami's service to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, in the spiritual world, everybody would be there together. Right? And it's, you know, it's understood you spent time and did service with this soul, but it's the material relationships that were there before aren't there. But as long as we're conditioned, the tendency is to see things according to the bodily condition. Does that make sense? So what we were meaning is that Bhaktivinoda Thakur is mentioning that in the beginning, we discussed this before, that the husband and wife are marrying each other because one's a man, one's a woman, and the desires and needs that they have and will gain from each other. But as time goes and they mature in their Krishna consciousness and their practice of Nishkam Karma Yoga, then they will come to the platform as souls being friends. That they're two individual souls who are servants of Krishna who are working together by performing their prescribed duties to please Krishna. So it changes. The important, what keeps them together is not because they're man and woman. What keeps them together is that it's a comfortable situation in which they are known, familiar situation in which they can perform devotional activities. So even in this lifetime, it's understood the science, one can change it. And then from there, then one goes back to Godhead, and then whatever is one's relationship there, that's another thing.
Might be split.
Definitely, generally, it will be split, because only in Vaikuntha do husband and wife who are performing devotional service stay together as husband and wife in Vaikuntha.
If they stay here together, they can stay there together.
That's in Vaikuntha. But in Goloka Vrindavan, then, you know, it's different. They may change the gender, they may not change the gender, but the point is they don't have that kind of relationship. You know, in other words, Krishna becomes the point of the relationship. You know what I'm saying? You have the parental rasa with Krishna. So therefore, then that's what the relationship is. And the evidence, that's not the important. Does that make sense? Say again?
For the field and the seed.
The field and the seed, yeah.
What is the field you are referring
to
the seed?
The seed's the man and the field's the woman. Right. So that's why the field and the seed should match. Right? If it doesn't match, you don't get a good result. So that's when the Vedic literature is equal natured persons should get married. If they're not equal, they shouldn't get married, because then the seed and the field don't match. Spinach won't grow nicely in clay. Just won't. You know, so it has to match. Makes sense? Then if it matches, then you get excellent result. The fruit is excellent. If not, it'll be weak either due to the fault, you know, either because of the fault of the non-matching, you know. Plus, if it's not nicely matched, the conscious is wrong, then the child will carry the faults of the mother or father or both. It's just the way it works. Does that make sense? So that's why in the Vedic culture it's so important that they're of equal nature and that children are not born out of wedlock or against religious principles. Because if any of those three are there, the child will be inferior. Yes? What do we mean by equal nature? Equal? Equal means that it's a basic common value system. That's it. It's, in other words, it's compatible. There's no such thing as equal, just the term is used as equal. Just like you would say in the performance of eating of soup, you know, a bowl and spoon are equal. You know, they match. The bowl and spoon go together, but the bowl and spoon in no way are equal. It's just a term used, meaning that the inherent nature of each's varna is basically the same. Like that. Is that the child, when they're born, they have an inherent nature. Then by training and application, then they become that. So that's most important for, you know, yeah, that's the meaning. That's how Mana describes it. So, in other words, a boy that has brahminical character and a girl that has brahminical inclination of that field of activity and ways of fulfilling her needs, they should be matched. Because if she has, she needs to fulfill her desires through a kshatriya social field, it'll be more difficult. Vaishya even worse, Shudra the worst. Yes, like that. So as you're seeing that, you know, you got your match of Sattva, Sattva, Rajas, Rajas, Tamas, Tamas, like that. That's the principle. Because then they'll be comfortable together, like that. Like that. No, equal here doesn't mean, it's just we're using the term because that's how Mana describes it. Equal here just meaning that they're from the similar kind of upbringing and background. You know, in other words, the boy's nature is that is brahminical, the girl's nature, she's come from that kind of background, therefore they're going to match nicely. Though, when they get married, that's when that will be brought out in the girl. Because it also mentions even the girl's from another background, if she's very chaste in that, she will naturally take on the qualities of the husband, whatever it is. That's why then Anuloma is not good, but it's okay. The pratiloma is not good at all. Because then if you have a girl that's more brahminically inclined, a husband who's shudra inclined, she has to drop in her qualities. While if she's shudra by nature, he's brahminical, she will be uplifted by the qualities. So she's going to adjust to wherever the husband is. That's why it should naturally be similar. Because then the inherent subconscious interaction will happen very smoothly. They won't have to think about it, you know, like that. Is that okay? So that's what's described in the Mana. Like that, yes.
Your explanation of the next generation being born is following
Varna
by birth.
Varna by birth. How much of influence of birth is there in your nature? 25%. Huh? But the question that the point we were making here is not about the varna. We were talking about the principle that's behind it. Like you will say here, because varna is made, okay, the father is brahminical. So the child generally would be, take generally on that quality, if they're born according to proper principles, everything. Yeah. So now, in that it may be brahminical or intellectual, but it may be they use their intellect not devotionally and use it materially. You know? So what we were comparing is the underlying good or bad points of the parents is inherent in the child. Huh? Means the varna will be how you apply. You know, the application, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yeah. So in other words, he was saying there's guna and karma, so unless you do the work. You may have the nature of brahminical, you don't do the brahminical work, you're a bhratya, you're a dvijabandhu, you're classified as a shudra. But that's not the point we're making. We're making here is that the child is going to, we were talking on values, that the child's values are going to be very similar to the parents, but how they express it may be different. That was the point. They're individual, yes. But do you catch the point? It means we were not talking here varnas. We were talking here, why is it the kid's grown up in a Krishna conscious environment and it doesn't seem to be interested in Krishna conscious activities? Right? So we're taking it back to the value of the parents. How do they value Krishna consciousness? You know, in what way have they made their decisions on their involvement in Krishna conscious activities? That principle the children generally take the same. They may take different, but generally take the same. If they don't think about it, they'll generally just take the same because it's default. If they think about it, then they may apply it differently. Does that make some sense here? Yes.
You say something so important about training. Sometimes we don't want to give people training because then we split. So we have school and gurukul. School still is a school, it's a family without a group. It's just like, it sounds like this school is just school. But it doesn't have the right training.
Mm.
So if we really want to give this Brahminical training to the Sattva, this Gurukul looks like it's essential. That's what Srila Prabhupada put it there.
Mm.
So, if for sentiment, we don't do that, how we can expect the best result?
How do we expect the best result? Point comes is that it's still going to be the value of the parent, what's important to them, because the parent always wants the best for the child. So depending on what they see as the most valued points, they're going to make that endeavor. Right? So that's going to make for your difference in what school systems people choose. It's still on the same principle of wanting to do the best for the child. So it's a similar thing. But their approach to it, one is that according to the tradition, then they get, you know, one kind of training, and then according to modern kind of like situation, then they expect something else. So one is looking at it generally more from the spiritual and devotional character platform. And from that, seeing that if that's right, there will be material success. And the other is looking at it from the economic and social platform, that if that is correct, then there'll be success. Yes? Yeah, he said the guru. Well, maybe the teachers needed a little work, but still he said the guru. And he was the grossest materialist you get. Yes, and then they're very materialistic. So that way you could have different kinds of gurukuls, you know, more spiritual, more materialistic. We have the Sunda Amarka Vidyalai, you know, like that, learn the, you know.
That means more along the lines of material.
Yeah. From there it would be, yeah, from that same. Yeah.
But then pointing deep in the water, one
Yeah, but the best.
Also, the son also wanted the best.
They had a different opinion. Yeah, so the principle is the same, you know, because the father had great affection, and Prahlad had great affection back. He wanted the best for the son wanted the best for the father, just they slightly had a different opinion on the method.
You know. One of the big mistakes in the personal life is to think that my duty is to settle them in a house, an apartment, and give them some money for the future. But you're saying that the Vikasa should prepare a wife and children to die.
Yeah, but in doing that,
yeah.
So yeah, the art of dying. So to it, because the tendency is to get distracted, then one provides the house and facilities and money so that they will concentrate on Krishna consciousness and the business of getting out of here. It does, but it's just on the principle we must be conscious of it, that it's a side thing. Just like we want to serve Prasad. So the main thing is devotees honoring Prasad. But we do have to think about plates and spoons and salt and sitting places and it's clean. And those are all secondary just to support. So if we don't have a spoon and we just have a bucket, you know, then... you know, it's not the greatest way to serve Prasad, and you know, the devotees may kind of get thrown off in their honoring of Prasad because you get too much on your plate, or it's a bit weird to come by and shake it out. You know, we've seen it in some temples, and brahmacharis, they can't find the spoon, and they just, you know, but, you know, you're dealing in quarter bucket increments there, so it doesn't really matter. But if you're talking about you just went a little bit, then you got a problem, so... So in that way, is because the house is there, then the wife and children are peaceful. Then they're willing to listen to the Krishna consciousness. So the difference is that the focus is actually giving the Krishna consciousness and taking back to Godhead. To do that, you take care of their material needs that they will be satisfied to where they'll listen. So that's why then also this thing of finding that equal satisfaction. The man is going to live at this level of economic development and devotional endeavor and all this, and the wife is willing to live at the same. Because if it's more, then it overbalances, and he's one, not going to be able to provide, and two, he's going to be upset because he wants to spend that time for one thing. Or maybe the opposite. You know, I've seen that also. Very Krishna conscious wife. Husband, much not, so, I mean, Krishna conscious, but wanting to get down to business. One was from a Brahminical background, the other was from a Vaishya background. And it was a big tug of war for years and years and years and years. So the wife, and now it's very peaceful because the wife just, you know, does like the husband, you know, doesn't go to the temple, doesn't do all these things. And now family life's very peaceful, you know. But in other words, that's the point of the balance, is that it, those things, if they're there, it's peaceful. You know, it's just like if we say today's fasting and there'll be a big feast at 2 o'clock. The fasting goes very nicely. But if we say, and you peacefully just do your japa and do everything, but if we say it's fasting today at 2 o'clock and, you know, it's every man for themselves, we're not preparing anything, that means you're going to be worried about and endeavoring to get food until 2 o'clock. You're not going to be chanting your japa and taking part in the program, you know. Or you will be there at the program, you know, to try to grab the Mahaprasad, you know. So, you know what I'm saying? So that's the whole idea, is if that sense of security is there, even though it's false, still the conditioned nature needs it. You know what I'm saying? That's why they're in family life, because they need the security of the fallible soldiers. But at the same time, they should be educated that even these aren't going to take care. But they're here. You know? That's all. So it's like you're dealing with the illusion in as much as needs to be so you can get one beyond. You know? You know, it's like putting the medicine into something sweet, something like that. They won't take it, it's bitter. You know, like this is all bitter. So if this comes in between, you know, nice discussions and like that, then it's okay. You know. Does that make some sense? Okay. Yes.
One point for the Guru is saying when the Brahmin was in the Guru and
And then this five men was a big astronaut, Prabhupada, and then he took care of him nicely. And then he did very nicely, and we didn't get from his teachers. Raska number one and all these things. He just told him very nicely. What he spoke was very nice and very appropriate. He kept all of his father was doing that. And then his father died, he got to the Shraddha, as he took over all his father's project was like maintaining the kingdom and all these things, he took over and he was doing it. So you can see that Sandham Pierce was like that idea that put my children in good for whatever, and that, like that kind of thing. That, if you can't solve the point, you can become a sannyasi and then just leave me alone and then just goes every day and then it would end up like, oh, now that you look, you know, like how I did to my parents, for example, you know, they are there in the house and I don't know.
Yeah, that's a natural thing. Actually, that you just hit on a very important point I've never thought about. It just came up now. Is because generally for many of us, we walk down on our parents to become Krishna conscious. There's always an underlying fear, if my child becomes too Krishna conscious, they'll leave me. Because that's what I did to my parents, you know. I never thought of that one before. That's a good one. Because I've seen that sometimes. Parents, they're very happy if the kid in a very nice way, cute way is Krishna conscious. But if they become very serious, I've seen many times the parents get worried, their security, because they're worried that the parent won't, that they won't need me, this and that. But the point is, this actual Gurukul system trains them in their prescribed duties in duty. So therefore, if they're inclined towards the household ashram, which most are, they will then interact and take care and do the right thing. I mean, as I've seen over the years, I don't remember seeing anyone coming out who's, one student maybe, who's moving at an early, you know, earlier age to go towards sannyas, like that. But all the rest of householders and doing very nicely, very beautiful, like that I know of. Like that, even our most like strongest brahmacharis and that, then they're married and very nice, you know, very good husbands and stuff like that. Okay, anything else? Yes. Did they all attain the same Gurukul? The concept, yes, but the particular, no. Because traditionally you'd have so many Gurukuls. You would have, because ideally is one teacher only deals with 12 students. Right? They can go beyond, but that's the recommendation, because generally speaking, most Brahmins aren't known for their managerial abilities. Right? They can create a nice atmosphere, inspiring, but they're not managers. So 12 kids works. It still works with him and his family and everything like that. But you can set up institutions and get them bigger. Or someone who has managerial ability, like you have Vishishta or Vishwamitra. Right? Vishwamitra was a king. Vishishta is always the Rajguru of the Sun dynasty. So the Rajguru, he actually is a manager. He has a whole parallel, background management for whatever the king has positions. He has positions to watch the king's positions. You know? But it's for the purpose of only giving advice. So they both have 10,000 disciples. So they know how to manage it. You know, so it works. But otherwise, 12 is mentioned, so there, it depends on what is there. So in Dwarka, I think it says there was 280,000 or 28,000 acharyas, means there were that many gurukuls running in Dwarka. Like that. So it's natural, because depending on what it is, generally you see, unless it's set up as a university, that each head of the Gurukul, though they're studied in the Vedic literatures, they have their predominant angle. You know, what Shastra... In other words, you're trying to get to Krishna, But you can get to Krishna through any of the Vedic literatures. Right? Does that make some sense? Therefore, you have somebody, their Gurukul, the predominant element may be Sanskrit, or it may be ritual, or it may be astronomy, astrology, or it may be music, or it may be, you know, martial arts like Dronacharya. But they still teach all the Vedic literatures, but the examples that you give will always be through that medium. Because the idea is you learn one of the fields very nicely so you can apply it in your life practically and understand the metaphysics and the philosophy behind it. That's the tradition. Then from that you can understand all the other fields. Once you catch one, you can catch them all. Like if you really know properly, let's say, how to deal with a cow, right? Then technically you can deal with any cow. You know, each cow is a little different, so you have to deal with it, but the principles are the same. Does that make sense? So that's the idea, is you learn, the schools tend to specialize in either one area or a combination, you know, of a few areas and like that. Does that make sense? So that way then you will choose. Plus you'll also have, you know, the particular nature of the teacher and one's faith in that teacher. So it, Vedika didn't matter which school you sent them to, it just, they went to a school. They would all go to Gurukul.
And until what age would they
attend? To what age? Basically until they're of maturity. So in the Vedic time, 16 they were mature. Modern, then they put it at 18. Supposedly they're mature, but but generally you see about 16 anyway. If they're only going to go not much longer, 16 they start to think practically, and then by 18 they're ready to move on. I've generally seen as whatever would kind of work in the Vedic, it's kind of like 2 years delayed in the modern, just by the background. Depends on the background. More Asian background tends to take more the time, because the Asians mature very quickly emotionally and socially because of the fabric that's there. Like that. But the Westerners intellectually are very sharp and know too much too early, but socially many times they're a little slower. Like that. So it basically works out. But Vedic would be as latest by 12 they should go in. And then they would come out. That's for Vaishyas. Go in at 12, come out at 16. That's latest. If you just want them to get the basic cultural training and all that, if you want them to get spiritual training, then they should go in earlier, at least by 8. You know? Like that. And if you really, So it's always, it depends what you want from them. Because, yeah, especially in business, the more pious you are, the more money you make. So the old, it means that I know of really traditional business families, they know that. So they're always doing whatever will be pious. You know, they'll give away all their money because they know if they give it away to the right source, they'll get so much more back. You know, I've seen them. I've had one business person myself say that. He had a shop, he gave it to the temple. Like that. And now, you know, he makes millions. He wasn't thinking like that at the time, but he just knew it was a good thing, so he did it, and then now he's convinced of that. So the Vaishyas would go to the school like that. Prabhupada recommends 5 to 25 if you can do it, because then there'll be that strength in the spiritual life and all that. But if not, then as early as possible to as late as possible. You know, that's it. But the window should be ideally no smaller than that 12 to 16. Because that's actually the time when they create their whole value system that'll go their whole life. You know, that's when all the things. By modern science, they've seen is that the brain grows, all parts of the brain grow together up to 12. And then from 12, only those parts of your brain you use, it keeps, and everything else it prunes back. Therefore, you know, you know, modern kids, all they can do is try to attract the opposite sex. So therefore, when they're still, when they're 40, 50, that's all they can do. You know, if you look back on it, that's a major problem. What we did from 12 to 18, 20 is the way we are today. Like that. You know, it's an important thing. That's why that time is so essential. But unfortunately, the modern culture tries to liberalize that and like that, but they don't actually know what they're dealing with. You know, so that's important. That's why the education has to be spiritual, well-rounded, practical. Like that, teenagers don't like things that aren't practical. So you have to have a lot of practical stuff. But people push academics, but then that's all they can do their whole life. They can't do anything practical. Right? So that's why in the teenage time, the practical is also so important, because you have to apply it. Has to be practical, has to be intellectual, there has to be good, strong interaction. They have to have the proper attitudes. Because when they get into their 20s, then it's set. You can change it after that, of course, intellectually, but I'm just saying you're naturally set with that. That's just what automatically will come. You know? Like if, you know, you're tough and mean and everybody's a write-off, then when you're in your 20s, everyone's a write-off. You'll have to intellectually think, no, this is not right, I should be nicer and that, and practice it. But you'll have to practice it because it won't come easy. But you can change it by keeping good association, by knowledge, by endeavor. You can change it, but the Vedic idea is, why do something that's going to be so much work later? The work is getting trained. Then after, you enjoy applying it. But the mantra is, enjoy when you should be trained, and then when you're supposed to be enjoying, then you're trying to, you know, you're out buying every self-help book there is on the market because you can't apply it, and you can't apply your, you know, you can't function. So the Vedic is the opposite. Bitter in the beginning, sweet at the end. You know, but the moderns somehow or another, they like the sweet at the beginning, and they really are confident, they have great faith that it will be sweet at the end. You know, I guess maybe after your, you know, 27th, you know, facelift and lipo job and, you know, spending $250,000, and it's not so bad. You know, but
so let's say we need to keep our children in a quiet, secure environment.
Yes. They should be secure. They should always feel secure. Generally, you check, the reason kids are out on their own is because they didn't feel secure in the house. You know, parents are saying Krishna conscious, bringing up Krishna conscious, but they're not there. The parent is looking after their own Krishna consciousness and wants to take the child along within that, rather than making that the child's Krishna consciousness also. It's a subtle difference. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's a very subtle difference. So the child doesn't feel secure. Otherwise, why would they go anywhere else? Right?
Yes.
They only go somewhere else because of the lack of security. Where it's secure, no one goes anywhere, because that's what the living entity in the material world is looking for. The security and enjoyment. Right? Mm-hmm. So the modern gives enjoyment but not security. Then they can't figure out what went wrong. So as long as the enjoyment's there, they stay together. As soon as the enjoyment's not, they part. Modern marriage, as long as the enjoyment's there, it stays together. When it's not, it breaks, because there's no security. But the Vedic, it's more on the security. Automatically, in security, you're going to get enjoyment. Because only if you're secure can you actually enjoy something. Right? So I sit you down in a very nice, peaceful place with nice friends and all that, give you something to eat, you can relish it. I put the same food down in the middle of an 8-lane highway and say, you know, here, go for it. You know, it'd be really hard to, you know, appreciate the subtleties of the food, you know.
Let's say after that time, if they all of a sudden move, let's say they don't appear in the article, and then all of a sudden when they're transformed,
New York, they'll do fine. They'll do great. Yeah. I've never seen anyone that grew up here fully absorbed that isn't anywhere else that's not doing great. Like that. Because that's the illusion, is that you have to grow up with it to know it. You know what I'm saying? It's just like you throw the kid into the cage with the lions, he doesn't know anything about lions, and therefore when he grows up, if he grows up, then he'll be expert at lions. Rather than he's trained separately. This is probably a great, one of major, major misunderstandings. It's just like this. The secure environment is just like this. Okay, now, if you look at it, even if we just take New York, and on the road, let's take Manhattan. You know, one of the, probably one of the toughest places in the world. One out of four persons there is Indian. Mm-hmm. One out of four. We're not even talking about Jersey, which, you know, is maybe even greater. We're talking about Manhattan. If you walk down the street there on Manhattan, New Gujarat, yeah. New Gujistan, right? Like that. Yeah, over there it's like, you know. So the point is, and they go there, and how are they living? Living. They're still living as Indians. Chinese are still living as Chinese. You know? Like that. And they're doing fine. They're rich, they're doing great, they're comfortable. So the point is that's not the way it works. You grow up, you're fed nicely, you're healthy and all that. Then if you go into an environment that may be less healthy, your body's strong and can resist. But to grow up in the environment of disease, maybe you're resistant to those diseases, but you're always in a disease condition. The kids on the street, you know, they can drink the water, eat the food, do all the things. They won't get necessarily as sick as you, but they're always sick. But if you're in good health, you can move through that because you know how to keep yourself healthy. But I've never seen. I mean, I think one of the main, biggest collectors and everything in Chicago, one of the main managers in the temple in San Diego. Someone who opened the temple and was the temple president in Phoenix. One of the main preachers after Umapati Maharaj in China Mission. Opened the whole and manages the whole preaching yoga center for Sydney. Like that. Was managing Indradyumna Maharaj's tour. They seem to do fine. The ones that grow up in the West, they're the ones that seem to have the problem with the West. They only can figure out, you know, girls and dope, like that. They figured out which end of the roach to stick in their mouth and which end of the girl to kiss, but other than that, they haven't gotten very far, you know? But that's about it. Because they don't know who they are and who anybody else is. You know that, you make it anywhere. And especially you're talking about those places. You're only going to make it in New York and London and Sydney and Los Angeles if you're a person. Right? Because that's what people look for. In New York, they don't judge you by what's your background, your education. They judge you how you react and how you interact. You interact nice, you're great. They listen to you. You get a job. You don't, they don't care for you. It's that simple. Otherwise, why is it that the Asians are taking over the West? Right? There's no poor Indians in the West. Poor Indians in India, but there's no poor Indians in the West. You know, think about it. You know, so that's the whole point, is that there must be something there in that upbringing and background that works. You know? So that's why Prabhupada is recommending, even materially, it's good. But it's a science, so it has to be run nicely. You know? Like that. It's a science. If you don't know the science, yes, there will be problem. But if you know the science, but it's a whole thing. It means the parents have to know it and have faith in it. Ideally, the kids have grown up in a similar environment. the kids from that have faith in it, and the teachers know what they're doing, and that. So that combination works really good. But if there's lack of faith or incompetency on any of them, then the system doesn't work so good. The modern is better. Teachers may not know what's going on, parents don't know what's going on, but somehow the system works, you know, because you have all these committees and this and that, and, you know, so many different things, you know. Like that, it's set up for that, like that, despite. But the Vedic is basically everybody must have faith, then it works. And if they don't, then that's where it breaks down. Faith, actually, faith and knowledge, they have to know what they're doing. You know. Is that okay? Okay. Yes.
Yesterday I heard that one young adult, 15 years old, hanged himself in a van. 15 years old, hanged himself in a van, killed himself. Oh. Out of too much pressure, being put in a school, studying this, studying that.
Mm-hmm.
So most of what we see here, what we are wearing, everything, you don't need to go to university to make it.
Mm-hmm.
All our environment, our clothing, everything is made by people who don't need university.
Mm-hmm.
But now so much pressure, everybody has to be going.
So much pressure, yeah. No, it's basic, is that so much pressure isn't required. Means pressure is there that we must be realistic about who we are. And whatever kind of vision we see for ourselves for the future, that we realistically have the qualities to attain that. Right? Because we can have the knowledge, but if we don't have the qualities, we won't make it. Because even you're talking about the competitiveness of the world, and you need a degree, when push comes to shove between two people with equal qualification, they'll take the one with the character over the one without the character. So the bottom line, that's coming in, you want to come in a good position. If you have the character, they'll take you in at the bottom, and you'll work your way up anyway. So if one has that kind of conviction, then it works. Because, as we say, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas are willing to take that risk. Because the nature of their service is a risk. You know, they have to depend, the Brahmins have to depend on the Lord. It means they just do their brahminical activities. Krishna sends something, doesn't send something. You know, Kshatriya has to use his, you know, use his diplomacy and politics like that and take that risk to protect his people. The Vaishya has to make his investment and try to sell something or try to, you know, create profit. He has to take that risk of investment. Shudras don't take risk. They want to be taken care of. Right? So the modern education is geared at that. Even if they are Brahmins, Kshatriyas, or Vaishyas, still they basically make most of them like Shudras. You're a doctor, but you work at a hospital. You have a job. You don't run your own clinic. That's risky. Because they train you not to take the risk. You're a businessman, but then you end up being swallowed up by bigger corporations. But it's comfortable. You end up with a job. You get a CEO or some other manager like this. So even though he's a Vaishya, he's acting as a Shudra. Kshatriyas, they're there, but they're still, they end up being bureaucrats or politicians. They're not standing on their own. So the system tends to make everybody into Shudras. So the tendency, therefore, is also to have that view on life, that you just want something that's very secure and stable and stuff like that. And at the same time, with all facility. Right? The Brahmin wants, you know, everybody wants, but they're willing to get it. So the Brahmin doesn't want to make the endeavor, so he's happy with nothing. You know, so in that way he creates his security by being satisfied. The Kshatriya, he gets, goes out and gets it. The Vaishya goes out and gets it. Shudra, it has to be handed to him. You know, he is willing to work, but you have to create the facility. Yeah. like that. So it's natural in the modern to be, you know, we've grown up in that, it's natural to be affected by that. But Prabhupada's trying to break that cycle to those that can appreciate and understand, to take advantage of the options given by the Vedic culture to be independent. Because if one takes any of those things seriously, one will be successful. You know? I mean, Brahminical, you take it. Every temple in the world is willing to take someone who knows how to cook for the deities or do puja. Right? But no one wants to do it because it's not secure. But every temple's dying for pujaris. Right? Preachers. Like, I've been to some temples, you know, after Mangalarti. My dear Lord Krishna, if you so desire, please send us some Sankirtan devotees. Right? They didn't say Brahmachari Sankirtan devotees. You know what I'm saying? You know, those who are very dedicated, and that so many of your original hardcore book distributors, you know, brahmacharis and that, they're married now and they're still book distributors and their life goes on fine. So the thing is any of the Brahminical sciences taken very seriously, one can maintain. Like that. Of course, one may find, depending upon one's position, one may have to live more simply or may not, depending upon on one's abilities and, you know, like that. But the point is Prabhupada is offering us the option to be independent. Like that. Therefore, the training and the character and all that, so that one can be independent. Because the Shudra, as long as he's good at his job, you know, he can build your cabinet, you'll put up with him being an annoyance for the 2 weeks, 3 weeks that he builds your stuff. But you can't be a Brahmin or Kshatriya and not have some good character. You know, that has to be predominant. Vaishya, the better character he has, generally the better he does. At least he can feign it. He can project it. You know? Like that. But, you know. But the Shudra doesn't really need. He has to be able to work with who he works for. But other than that, he doesn't. Once he leaves the office or the job, he doesn't have to have it. He doesn't have to have any good character. Yeah. Okay, last point.
Yeah. There are questions on algorithms to touch. For example, the first algorithm in one's life is the mother, mm-hmm. the father, then the close relatives, the teachers, then the who is in charge, like job in charge, or GVC or something, the different structure, there's a whole structure there. And suddenly the problem with being, for example, investment center or investment day of everything working, there's not a problem with the primary part of the parampara, for example, parents or teacher, or somebody is wrong or bad, or it's a low character, whatever, because it has a we see that everything is zero, the other everything is virtual material. And from there, they're taking on everything from that time on. So, we get from there, from zero, we can get it. We say Krishna is God, he's the author, and the guru is there, and the partner is the purpose, and another thing. But sometimes we have a problem that even the parampara structure, like the teacher or the parents, be it either side, any side, sometimes we have a problem that we can't go further than that because the authorities, for example, my authority has a lower standard than me, so I can't train my students or something, whatever, further or balances, so whatever, somebody has a father has lower, mother has lower character than mother, so the mother does not understand where the father character is the standard to establish in the children that higher part of the father
was over the father. So what's the point? The
point is that how to add this kind of problems and you have different character, a different in standards or something.
In this,
how
do you deal with the thing? I mean, the Vedic concept authority is three. Mother, father, guru. Within that, then you have many breakdowns, right? You know, any the older sister, you know, the elder women of the family, they're all mother, right? That the Brahmin's wife, they, you know, like this, so many are mother. Then father, then you have like that. And then, so technically you only have mother and father, but because one is the material aspect of father, biological, and the other is the spiritual, therefore guru. Like that, because one gives birth for, you know, material facility, one gives birth for spiritual. So then, these are the three authorities, right? Then within that, the teachers and all that come within guru, because the guru who teaches you the philosophy and the application in your life, that's acharya. They teach you a portion of the Veda or some art or science, that's a sub-teacher, upadhyaya. If they perform your rituals, your household rituals and that, then they're the kulu guru, or just guru. And if they perform a sacrifice for you, you know, like that, as an officiating priest, they're officiating guru. We'll leave the Sanskrit term. Like that. So that all fits in there. So each has their breakdowns. So the idea is that one should not disrespect any of them. But if on the material platform, in other words, Prahlad Maharaj, as you point out, didn't disrespect his father. He didn't. His advice wasn't followable, but he culturally dealt nicely. Because ultimately, then on the spiritual platform, then the guru is the father, and the Veda is the mother, or the Gayatri is the mother. The scriptures, the mother. So then in that, then you have that connection. So you're not missing something. You know, so if the parents are favorable, then it's there, and then any senior devotees like that, they're also, they have the element of mother and father and guru like this. So it all works nicely. But if it's missing, you don't have that, then the scriptures are the mother, the spiritual master is the father. Standard is lower in the system. No, you just means you have your standards and you basically follow them. The principle is there. You just find the detail that works in that environment. Principle is maintained. Right? The detail you may have to adjust. You know, you have your standard of, I chant my japa in the morning before, you know, Mangal Arati or before I eat or something like that. Someone else just, you know, do your service and get your rounds in. Both want you to get your 16 rounds done. So the detail may be different. So since service comes up here and there, then you adjust that. But you have your value in your rounds. So whenever you chant, you'll do it nicely. It's only because you like chanting, therefore you'll pick the best time for it. But if you can't pick the best time, still whenever you can, then you'll chant nicely. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So you have to look at what's the principle of the standard. And to attain that principle, I have chosen this detail. It may be the best detail, it may be a traditional detail, but it's a detail. And then see how we're accomplishing that principle. Does that make sense? Okay, so we'll end here. So for the day, Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Chaitanya Gaur Srimana ki.
To continue our preaching and
questions, he said unto his mother,
I have been belabored by the brothers of Janamejaya. And his mother replied, thou hast committed some fault for which thou hast been beaten. Right? In other words, immediately, then it's seen that it's their fault. Did he do something that they, you know what I'm saying? In other words, why would somebody do something unless you did something wrong? Right? So that's the first thing. Rather than the son is always right and everybody else is wrong. No. Something happens, then the son must have done something wrong. And then if he says, no, I did nothing wrong, then you consider, okay, maybe the others are behaving badly.
I don't understand.
It means while the yagya is going on, then Sarama's son, you know, small dog, he came to the yagya. And coming, yeah.
Sarama's a dog?
Yeah. It says celestial dog. Right. And so then they harassed him, and then they ask why, what fault. He answered, I have not committed any fault. I have not touched the sacrificial butter with my tongue, nor have I even cast a look upon it. His mother Sarama, hearing this, much distressed at the affliction of her son, went to the place where Janamejaya with his brothers was at his long extended sacrifice. And she addressed Janamejaya in anger, saying, this my son hath committed no fault. He hath not looked upon your sacrificial butter, nor hath he touched it with his tongue. Wherefore hath he been beaten? Means why was he beaten? Right? You know, just because he's a dog, so they whacked him. Because they expect dogs will come and look at this, but he's a celestial dog, so he knows that, you know, you don't do these things. Because right? That's what dogs do. They go out and see the ghee, and then they go and sniff it or look at it or, you know, lick it. They said not a word in reply, whereupon she said, as ye have beaten my son, who hath committed no fault, therefore shall evil come upon ye when ye least expect it.
Dog cursed him.
Yeah.
What was the question?
That just as the son did nothing wrong, and he got, you know, some misfortune came to him. So in the same way, when they least expect it, for no reason, just misfortune will come to them. Janamejaya, thus addressed by the celestial dog, Sarama, became exceedingly alarmed and dejected, and after the sacrifice was concluded, returned to Hastinapur and began to take great pains in searching for a Purohit who could, by procuring absolution for his sin, neutralize the effect of the curse. Right? So after the yajna was done, then he found someone to try to do a sacrifice by which he could neutralize his curse. One day, Janamejaya, the son of Parikit, while hunting, observed in a particular part of his dominions, a hermitage where dwelt a certain rishi of fame, Shrutashrava. He had a son named Somashrava, deeply engaged in ascetic devotions. Being desirous of appointing that son of the rishi as his Purohit, Janamejaya, the son of Parikit, saluted the rishi and addressed him, saying, O possessor of the six attributes, let this thy son be my Purohit. The rishi thus addressed answered Janamejaya, O Janamejaya, this my son, deep in ascetic devotions, accomplished in the study of the Vedas, and endued with the full force of my asceticism, is born of the womb of a she-snake that hath drunk. He is able to absolve thee from all offenses save those committed against Mahadev. Except what's committed against Lord Shiva. Right? It means if you committed offense to Lord Shiva, then he can't help you. But if it's any other kind of thing, then he can help. Of course, if it's against Krishna, he may not be able to help. Krishna, the Vaishnavas, but the material platform. But he hath one particular habit, namely, he would grant to any Brahmin whatever might be begged of him. If thou canst put up with it, then thou take him. Janamejaya, thus addressed, replied to the rishi, I shall be even so, and accepting him for his Puruhit, he returned to his capital. And he then addressed his brother, saying, "This is the person I have chosen for my spiritual master. Whatsoever he may say must be complied with by you without examination." And his brothers did as they were directed. And giving these directions to his brothers, the king marched towards Takshashila and brought that country under his authority. About this time, there was a rishi, Ayodhya Domna by name, and Ayodhya Domya, like Domya was with the Pandavas, so this is Ayodhya Domya. And Ayodhya Domya had three disciples, Upamanyu, Aruni, and Veda. And the rishi bade one of these disciples, Aruni of Panchala, to go and stop up a breach in the watercourse of a certain field. So this is about the same time, they're not connected, just around the same time as all this was going on. So in other words, you know, one story is starting, was running, now he started another story, and they'll have some connection at some point. Right. So it means that a breach means an opening, it means you have the water, you know, when they run it out to the fields, if it breaks, then the water just goes here and there, so he had to stop that water going. And Aruni of Panchala, thus ordered by his preceptor, repaired to the spot. And having gone there, he saw that he could not stop up the breach in the watercourse by ordinary means. And he was distressed because he could not do his preceptor's bidding. But at length he saw a way and said, "Well, I will do it in this way." He then went down to the breach and lay down himself there, and the water was thus confined. Right? It was too big. So if it's so big, if one person put some dirt, it'll just be washed away. So he decided if he just lays down there, then he can stop the water. After some time, the preceptor, Ayodhya Domya, asked his other disciples where Aruni of Panchala was. And they answered, "Sir, he hath been sent by yourself, saying, go stop up the breach in the watercourse of the field." Thus reminded, Domya, addressing his pupils, said, "Then let us all go to the place where he is." And having arrived there, he shouted, "Ho, Aruni of Panchala, where art thou? Come hither, my child." And Aruni, hearing the voice of his preceptor, speedily came out of the watercourse and stood before his preceptor. And addressing the latter, Aruni said, "Here I am in the breach of the watercourse. Not having been able to devise any other means, I entered myself for the purpose of preventing the water running out. It is only upon hearing thy voice that, having left it and allowed the waters to escape, I have stood before thee. I salute thee, Master. Tell me what I have to do." You know, in other words, we see and hear is that he explained what he did, but at the same time that he already had some activity. You know what I'm saying? Many times you see boys will be there and someone else will say, "Oh, can you go do this or go do that?" And then they'll do it without saying, "Oh, but I'm supposed to be doing this. And I'm supposed to be doing the offering now." Then they would say, "Oh, okay, you do the offering, they'll find someone else." But instead of saying, "No, I'm supposed to do the offering," then they say, "Oh, can you go to the temple and do this?" And then no one does the offering. That makes sense? So you should always explain what's going on already. Then it's clear. The other person knows, you know, then how to make a decision. Right? Does that make sense? Does that make sense? The preceptor thus addressed replied, "Because in getting up from the ditch thou hast opened the watercourse, henceforth shalt thou be called Udalaka, as a mark of thy preceptor's favor." Right? Udalaka was the one we were talking about. No, that was Utanka.
Utanka, yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's some connection here between Udalaka and Utanka. "And because my words have been obeyed by thee, thou shalt obtain good fortune. And all the Vedas shall shine in thee, and all the Dharma Shastras also." And Aruni, thus addressed by his preceptor, went to the country after his heart. It means he went back to Panchala, where he was from. In other words, previously in the Gurukul, you went to the Gurukul and you stayed your full time of study, whatever you made your vow to study. and only after that, then they went home. Does that make sense? They didn't go home in between. They didn't go home on the weekends or once a month, or, you know, go out for, you know, 2 months at the end. You know what I'm saying? They just didn't go. They were just there the whole time. Then like that, and then when they finished their training, then they would go home, and then they would be fully engaged in the household activities and like that. That makes sense? Because the Vedic idea is whatever you do, do it fully. The name of another of Ayodhya Domya's disciples was Upamanyu. And Domya appointed him, saying, "Go, my child, Upamanyu, look after the kine," means cows. And according to his preceptor's orders, he went to tend the kine. And having watched them all day, he returned in the evening to his preceptor's house. And standing before him, he saluted him respectfully. And his preceptor, seeing him in good condition of body, asked him, "Upamanyu, my child, upon what dost thou support thyself? Thou art exceedingly plump." And he answered, "Sir, I support myself by begging." And his preceptor said, "What is obtained in alms should not be used by thee without offering it to me." In other words, whatever the brahmachari gets under the teacher, that goes to the teacher. Just like if the son is under the care of the father, whatever money he makes goes to the father. Right? Or the wife, whatever money she makes goes to the father, or the husband. You know, so whoever's care you're under, then the money goes to them, or the facility goes to them. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like that. Gift is another thing, what you do as an occupation. You understand? There's a difference. You know, just like the wife may work, so the money that comes from that actually belongs to the husband. But if someone gives her a gift out of affection, that belongs to her. You understand? So there's a difference.
What about if, like, a brahmachari in the gurukuls, if he gets a gift from someone else, does he offer it to the teacher?
Generally would, because the gifts that they would get would only be in line with what they would use. You know, cloth or deer skin or water pot or things like that. So generally that would only be like, the, you know, they go to some program and they give. But it would be in that way. It would be like they're... It's different, you know, because they're brahmachari. But when they're married, then it's theirs. You know? So even if you have brothers and somebody gets a gift, even though they're living co-jointly, that gift is theirs. It's not to be shared. You know? It is gained by his own endeavor without using the father's property. Then that gain is his. Does that make sense? Right? But if it's taken, he's using the father's facilities to get it, then it's shared amongst the brothers. Because everybody will be doing that, and whatever they get, it's all shared. That makes sense? And Upamanyu thus told went away, and having obtained alms, he offered the same to his preceptor. And his preceptor took from him even the whole. And Upamanyu, thus treated, went to attend the cattle. And having watched them all day, he returned in the evening to his preceptor's abode. And he stood before his preceptor and saluted him with respect. And his preceptor, perceiving that he still continued to be of good condition of body, said to him, "Upamanyu, my child, I take from thee even the whole of what thou hast obtainest in alms, without leaving anything for thee. How then dost thou at present contrive to support thyself?" Right? Because he took everything, so how is it still he's doing okay? And Upamanyu said unto his preceptor, "Sir, having made over to you all that I obtain in alms, I go a-begging a second time for supporting myself." And his preceptor then replied, "This is not the way in which thou shouldest obey the preceptor. By this thou art diminishing the support of others that live by begging." In other words, if you go begging twice, you're taking someone else's. So you go once, and that's what you get, because other people are also begging. So if you go out twice, then what other people would get would be getting less. All right, so in here he's slowly trying to make him conscious of what's going on around him. "Truly, having supported thyself so, thou hast proven thyself covetous," you know, that you're taking others' you know, covet, you covet something means you want somebody else's. So he's taken others. And Upamanya, having signified his assent to all that his preceptor said, went away to attend the cattle. And having watched them all day, he returned to his preceptor's house. And he stood before his preceptor and saluted him respectfully. And his preceptor, observing that he was still fat, said again to him, Upamanya, my child, I take from thee all thou obtainest in alms, and thou dost not go a-begging a second time, and yet art thou in healthy condition. How dost thou support thyself? And Upamanya thus questioned answered, Sir, I now live upon the milk of these cows. And his preceptor thereupon told him, It is not lawful for thee to appropriate the milk without having first obtained my consent. And Upamanya, having assented to the justice of these observations, went away to tend the kine. And when he returned to his preceptor's abode, he stood before him and saluted him as usual. And his preceptor, seeing that he was still fat, said, Upamanya, my child, thou eatest no longer of alms, nor dost thou go begging a second time, nor even drinkest the milk, yet art thou fat. By what means dost thou contrive to live now? And Upamanya replied, Sir, I now sip the froth that these calves throw out while sucking their mother's udders. Right? Means when the calves suck, then all this foam goes. They don't, they're, you know, they're kids, so they're messy. Right? And the preceptor said, These generous calves, I suppose, out of compassion for thee, throw out large quantities of froth. Wouldest thou stand in the way of their full meals by acting as thou hast done? Know that it is unlawful for thee to drink the froth. So he's showing him that in maintaining yourself, you should not cause distress to others. That's one of the principles of a Brahmin. His occupation that he does doesn't disturb anybody else. Right? And Upamanya, having signified his assent to this, went before, as before, to tend the cows. And restrained by his preceptor, he feedeth not on alms, nor hath he anything else to eat. He drinketh not of the milk, nor tasteth he of the froth. And Upamanya, one day, oppressed by hunger, went in a forest, ate of the leaves of the arka, and his eyes being affected by the pungent, acrimonious, crude, and saline properties of the leaves which he had eaten, he became blind. And as he was crawling about, he fell into a pit. And upon his not returning that day, when the sun was sinking down behind the summit of the western mountains, the preceptor observed to his disciples that Upamanya was not yet come. And they told him that he had gone out with the cattle. The preceptor then said, Upamanya, being restrained from me, from the use of everything, is, of course, and therefore doth not come home until it be late. Let us go in search of him. And having said this, he went with his disciples into the forest and began to shout, saying, Ho, Upamanya, where art thou? And Upamanya, hearing his preceptor's voice, answered in a loud tone, Here I am at the bottom of a well. And his preceptor asked him how he had happened to be there. And Upamanya replied, Having eaten of the leaves of the arka plant, I became blind, and so I have fallen into this well. And his preceptor thereupon told him, Glorify the twin Ashvinis, the joint physicians of the gods, and they will restore thee thy sight. And Upamanya, by eating the leaves of the arka tree. That's what it says here. Asclepius Gigantea. If that helps at all. And Upamanya, thus directed by his preceptor, began to glorify the twin Ashwinis in the following words of the Rig Veda. Ye have existed before the creation, ye firstborn beings. You are displayed in this wondrous universe of five elements. I desire to obtain you by the help of the knowledge derived from hearing and of meditation, for ye are infinite.
Yes. what kind of knowledge they were getting by meditation, what kind of knowledge, because he said that by getting knowledge by hearing and meditation. So, is that another way to get knowledge?
Means contemplation, means you hear the knowledge, and then you think about it and you apply it, right? Then you get the result. That makes sense?
Yeah.
You know, so that's the process, right? Shravanam, manana, nididhyasana. So shravanam means you hear, nidid, manana means you contemplate and you practice it. Okay? So that's standard. Just that they use poetic ways this way, that way. Also, when it's translated into English, it will come out slightly different. But it's, you know, the same basic principles are there. It's just said in very, very kind of poetic ways and all that kind of thing. Okay, mixing the three colors. Ye have produced all the objects of sight. It is from these objects that the universe hath sprung. Thereupon the gods and men are engaged in their respective occupations. And indeed, all creatures endued with life. Ye Ashwinis, I adore you. I also adore the sky, which is your handiwork. Ye are the ordainers of the fruits of all acts, from which even the gods are not free. Ye are yourselves free from the fruits of your acts. Ye are the parents of all. As males and females, it is ye that swallow the food, which is subsequently develops into the life-creating fluid and blood. In other words, digestion.
Ashwini Kumaras are in charge of medicine?
Yeah.
They learn that from Dadvantar?
That I'm not sure. But in other words, the health aspect is empowered in them, right? So always the demigods, whatever their potencies are, they're coming from Krishna. And coming from Krishna, then they, in one sense, you can, you can say it to them because they're the potency of the Lord, but actually the prayers are meant for the Lord. You know what I'm saying? Because they're the office, and in that office it's in charge of that potency of the Lord. Does that make sense? Like you have an officer in charge of electricity. The electricity belongs to the government, but he's in charge of it. So then you can say, oh, you're the controller of electricity, you are the greatest, you're this, that. But actually, he's just the guy doing it, because it's the government that actually the electricity belongs to. Does that make sense? So that's why sometimes you see in these Vedas, they'll put so much prayers to the demigods, but actually they're all prayers meant for Vishnu. Because actually only he is actually how you say? Worshipable like that. Ye Ashwinis, grant me my sight to protect my life. The twin Ashwinis, thus invoked, appeared and said, we are satisfied. Here is a cake for thee. Take and eat it. And Upamanyu, thus addressed, replied, your words, O Ashwinis, have never proved untrue. But without first offering this cake to my preceptor, I dare not take it. And the Ashwinis thereupon told him, formerly thy preceptor had invoked us. We thereupon gave him a cake like this, and he took it without offering it to his master. Do thou do that which thy preceptor did. Thus addressed of Upamanyu again said unto them, O Ashwinis, I crave your pardon. Without offering it to my preceptor, I dare not apply this cake. The Ashwinis then said, oh, we are pleased with this devotion of thine to thy preceptor. Thy master's teeth are of black iron. Thine shall be of gold. Thou shalt be restored to sight and shalt have good fortune. Thus spoken to by the Ashwinis, he recovered his sight. Right? In other words, he was learning that whatever activity, it goes through the spiritual master. Does that make sense? So he was fixed in that. You know, because they were saying that his spiritual master before had a problem with his eyesight. He got a cake and he ate it because he wasn't under the thing that he, that, you know, was directly saying everything, you know, specifically had to be physically offered. You know, in other words, you should do all your activities for. Right? So he was gaining his eyesight back for the service of his spiritual master. But here, Upamanyu has been specifically told anything he gets, it has to go through only by the spiritual master's permission. Because he's, you know, teaching him this point. Right? That's the point. Everything that's there, it's learned in some story. So this is the story that you learn this principle from. That everything's done with the permission of the spiritual master. Right. So it's the most extreme because it very much clearly makes the point.
What would you do? We should learn from the previous story of stopping the...
Means that one is willing to do anything to accomplish the order of the spiritual master. Right? There you want to get anything done. Here you're completely dependent upon the order of the spiritual master. Right? The other one, you use your intelligence, you apply whatever has to be done. Right. Thus spoken to by the Ashwins, he recovered his sight, and having gone to his preceptor's presence, he saluted him and told him all. And his preceptor was well pleased with him and said unto him, "Thou shalt obtain prosperity, even as the Ashwinis have said. All the Vedas shall shine in thee, and all the Dharma Shastras." This was the trial of Upamanyu. In other words, this was the test. This is their test. Right? They didn't sit down and do the, you know, other exam. You know? Then Veda. The other disciple of Ayodhadamya was called. His preceptor once addressed him, saying, "Veda, my child, tarry some time in my house and serve thy preceptor. It shall be to thy profit." And Veda, having signified his assent, tarried long in the family of his preceptor, mindful of serving him. Like an ox under the burdens of his master, he bore heat and cold, hunger and thirst, at all times without a murmur. And it was not long before his preceptor was satisfied. And as a consequence of that satisfaction, Veda obtained good fortune and universal knowledge. And this was the trial of Veda. Right? So here, in other words, that one is, without expecting any return under any condition, is willing to serve and please. Does that make sense? So we can see the opening story is the first teaching, the surrender to Guru. Because right, that's the first one, the Dharma Shastras start, the first thing they establish is the dealings with the teacher. Right, because that's where it starts with brahmachari life and starts with that. So here also, since this is teaching all the different rules and regulations of the religious principles, then it starts with that naturally itself. That makes sense? Right. And Veda, having received permission from his preceptor, and leaving the latter's residence after the completion of his studies, entered the domestic mode of life. But while living in his own house, he got three pupils, and he never told them to perform any work or to obey implicitly his own behests. For having himself experienced much woe while abiding in the family of his preceptor, he liked not to treat them with severity. Right? So he was, because it was very strong, so therefore he had a tendency not to... Okay, now we go into the story of the Tanka. This is all now going to the Tanka. Thank you. Yeah. So we understand here? So then in here, then from the disciples, and we're learning these principles that we'll use our intelligence and go to any length to serve the order, that we will be dependent upon the order, and we are, you know, the mood of service, you know, is very much fixed, and one is willing to, because it's said that by serving the spiritual master, having faith in Guru and Krishna, then all the imports of the Veda will be revealed. Like we see here is that he said that they will be fortunate and they'll have all knowledge, right? Like that. So that's what I get. Okay. Yes? Any questions on this? Okay, so stop here. This then. Then today is what, Tuesday?
Today?
Tuesday. So then on Thursday, then we'll hear the story of Utanka. Yeah, in the earrings, yeah.
Maharaj, was it wrong that he didn't teach the students? And he wasn't like...
Oh, he may have been using a different method, but it's just said that he was being very... He was using a different style of teaching. You know, it means the point is that the student should learn, you know, the proper knowledge and proper character. So one can do that either very sharply or softly, or, you know, there's so many different methods you could use. Like we see Drona would also use some interesting methods, you know, after they're trained. You know, then he had that thing with the bird and the tree. Right? And so then he's asking, okay, what do you see? You know, bird, the tree, him, this, you know, so he's asking, do you see me, do you see this, that? And they tell him, okay, step away. And after everybody's gone through, and he stepped, then Arjuna says, what do you see? I only see the bird. And he says, okay, describe it to me. Well, actually, I only see the head of the bird. You know. And so he's just aiming at the eye, right? And so then he says, okay, then you shoot. So that's the point. If you're going to be, whatever it means, it's in specific here, he's applying it to the martial science, that unless you're focused that much, you're not going to hit your target. But in life, unless you're focused, you will not get the work done that you want to get done. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Like that. Focus is important. So sometimes by this strong method, then one focuses, it becomes aware, and then, you know, does some very nice things. Udalaka, you'll see him come up here and there. So he became one of the great sages.
What?
Udalaka, the one that laid down in the water and stopped the water from going. You'll see him come up later. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.